National Radio Club.
Howdy, Xers. Welcome to Market Scope for December 2010. It's back to Huntsville, Alabama, as Tim Hendel begins his narrative on the FM side of the dial.
This is Tim Hendel here in Huntsville with Market Scope Part 2, the FM dial. I will try to give you a little bit of history and information about each station as we go up the dial, and I may also have some strictly personal comments about FM translators. We begin at the very, very beginning, 88.1, Way FM, W-A-Y-H. Way FM seems to be, in fact, a format. There's a Way FM in Nashville, W-A-Y-M, at 88.7. And when I first moved here, Way FM in Huntsville simply simulcast the Nashville station. But now they have their own studios and their own programming. The best way to describe this format is Christian rock. And believe me, if you didn't listen to the words to the songs, you would never know that this was not a commercial rock station. Many of the stations between 88 and 92 seem to be walking a very thin line regarding commercials. 88 to 92 is supposed to be non-commercial. NPR has underwriting messages, and sometimes I think these underwriting messages get pretty close to commercials. But nobody seems to come as close to actual commercials as the Christian stations do. I'm going to give you at least one example of one of the commercials that Way FM runs, and you tell me if that's a commercial. We'll give you the ID. Their actual city of license is Harvest, which is a community just outside of Huntsville. They really are a Huntsville station. They have a morning show with lots of people talking and chatting, just as most of the other commercial FMs do. Maybe the show is a little bit less risque, but there again, you can sometimes hardly tell the difference between it and a regular FM station. So let's hear just a little bit of Way FM. If this is a format you're not familiar with, then you'll be hearing something perhaps interesting.
Our thanks to Heritage Florists and Gifts for being a business impact partner of listener-supported Way FM. They're located at 1871 Slaughter Road in Madison. They offer fresh floral arrangements from memorial sprays to vases and baskets to green plants and silks. Heritage also has home accents, balloon bouquets, birth celebration items, and gift baskets. Their phone number is 837-7022. Way FM thanks Sydney Ishii and the staff at Heritage Florists and Gifts for helping to keep us growing.
Cook's Pest Control shares your values for a strong, healthy community and is one of listener-supported Way FM's business impact partners. Cook's has provided pest control and termite protection services for Southern homes and businesses for 82 years, and they offer inspections, consultations, and estimates. Cook's now provides a mosquito management program for yards and patios during the summer months. Cook's Pest Control can be found alphabetically in the white pages on the Way FM Business Impact Partner webpage or online at www.cookspest.com.
Headlines the service of a nurturing moment maternity boutique on Airport Road.
Forecast for Huntsville, the surrounding communities, a service of Dr. Michael Pugh, online at artisticdentistry.net. For today, clouds, some breaks of sun, watch for a shower of about 73 today. It'll clear off overnight 50. Sunshine tomorrow, high of 75. Tomorrow night, clear, lows near 50. Mostly sunny, the story for Wednesday, highs will be up around 80. I'm meteorologist Rob Carrollton for 88.1.
Mornings with Brent. It's easy to find us on Facebook. Facebook.com/morningswithbrent. Mornings with Brent, a service of Dr. William Mitchell at Huntsville Laser Center and 88.1 WAYH, Harvest Huntsville. We're online at wayfm.com. 88.1
FM. Uh-oh, show's almost over, and we're gonna get a joke here. And you gave us duck-billed platypus and bagel.
I gave you a little more of the music and the sound of Way FM than I might on some of the commercial rock and country stations, because I thought that if you don't have this format in your area, you might find it a bit unusual. Every market has access to at least one national public radio station. Some have more than one. NPR is really just about the only thing I listen to on the radio anymore. And here in Huntsville, we have 89.3 WLRH, transmitting with 100,000 watts. WLRH is one of the best NPR stations I know of as far as featuring and focusing on local arts. On the other hand, WLRH is one of the technically worst stations I know of, although they have improved. They're always going off the air. I don't know what their problem is. They come back on and they never will tell you why they were off the air. If I were running a radio station, I would explain it. They used to upcut the network a lot. Sometimes you'd hear two promos broadcast at the same time and other times of other kinds of glitches. And while they've improved, they're still a little bit sloppy. But their local personalities are wonderful as far as keeping us in touch with the artistic community here in Huntsville. What we're going to hear is the 8 o'clock AM ID with Ginny Kennedy, one of their morning people. They do a 5-minute local newscast at 6 minutes past 6, 7, and 8 a.m., and that's about all the local news you get on WLRH. Then we'll hear the ending of the afternoon program, which is called Among Friends with Beth Norwood.
This is 89.3 FM WLRH in Huntsville, your NPR member station. The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a dense fog advisory in effect until 9 o'clock this morning. A little bit foggy outside of our studios on the UA Huntsville campus, but it is clearer than it was a couple of hours ago. Temperature hanging steady at 52 degrees. We'll see mostly sunny skies later on today with highs reaching the mid-70s. Mostly clear tonight. Lows could drop into the upper 40s. Tomorrow we'll see mostly sunny skies with a high near 80 degrees. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. You're listening to Morning Edition on 89.3 FM WLRH in Huntsville. Good morning. It's 6 minutes past 8 o'clock. I'm Ginny Kennedy with the state and local news.
2:57. This is WLRH Huntsville. I hope you've enjoyed our little jaunt through part of the alphabet this afternoon. Today's programming on WLRH is made possible in part by listeners like you and in honor of Glenn Nettleton on his birthday today from Joe McDonald, who says, Happy birthday, Grumpy.
Huntsville Bengali Association presents Tal Damaka, a classical music performance featuring Alokparna Guha's Kathak dance, Snehasis Mozumdar on band.
Weather for tonight, mostly clear, a low of 50. For tomorrow, sunny, a high of 82. WLRH Huntsville, your station for classic and classical music and in-depth news. Our studios and offices are on the campus of the University of Alabama in Huntsville.
This is now the time to talk to you about translators, something that I consider one of the biggest nuisances on the FM band, at least for the most part. Several years ago, there was a proposal for low-power FM, LPFM, in which stations running from 10 to 100 watts would provide what's missing in radio, much local programming. Both the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio opposed low-power FM. They said that you couldn't have a low-power FM station within three channels of a full-power station without causing interference. In other words, if you have a station on 89.3, then 89.9 was too close. So why is it the translators get to be within two channels? We've just heard 89.3. We will hear a full-power station on 90.1, but stuck in the middle on 89.7 is a translator. I would accept translators in those cases where an AM station can't cover its local area, especially at night. But here we have an example of a translator relaying programs from a station thousands of miles away. It used to be called Calvary Satellite Network. It now seems to be called Christian Satellite Network. The originating station seems to be KAWZ in Twin Falls, Idaho, although I think the programming comes from California. This bunch has translators all over the country. As far as I know, hundreds of these things. They don't do a thing for the local community. They don't even do a thing for the local religious community. They don't have any information about local churches, local religious activities. They just pump out their satellite-engendered programming 24 hours a day. They used to identify one or two translators each hour, but on the ID I got, they only identified the main station, not any of the translators. Also, for some reason, when I recorded this ID today, the audio was a little muffled. It's normally not that way, but this is the translator on 89.7.
Do This is KAWZ Twin Falls, the Christian Satellite Network.
On 90.1, we have the station of Oakwood University. Oakwood College was founded shortly after the Civil War by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and it is still run by this church. It was mainly founded as a school to educate the recently freed slaves who hadn't been allowed to get an education. It is still primarily a black college, and about 2 years ago they went from being Oakwood College to Oakwood University. I don't know how they got that upgrade or what they had to do. And their station changed call letters. It was WOCG to stand for Oakwood College. It is now WJOU. Obviously, the OU stands for Oakwood University. Maybe the J stands for Jesus. I'm not sure. Most of their programming is black gospel. They do have some local programming, local news and stuff. I don't know whether that's done by the students at Oakwood College or not. They also do have a couple of programs provided by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, such as The Voice of Prophecy and Our Daily Bread.
Praise 90.1 FM, WJOU, Huntsville.
IRN USA Radio News, I'm Hope Duggar.
Tonight we'll have lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, Wednesday, will be sunny with highs in the upper 70s, and Wednesday night will be clear with lows in the upper 40s. Currently here in Huntsville, it is 69 degrees.
Experience the difference. Praise 90.1 FM.
Coming up next is John Stoddard singing Have You Ever Been Lonely? Stay tuned for more uplifting music and also at 12:30, Our Daily Bread here on Praise 90.1 FM WJOU.
Now on to 90.9, another college station from another black university, Alabama A&M University here in Huntsville. The station is WJAB, and in fact you heard an advertisement for Alabama A&M's homecoming on one of the AM stations that we did. The primary format on WJAB is jazz. They do carry a few NPR things. The first hour of Morning Edition, which is simulcasted with WLRH. They carry some NPR programs that the other stations don't carry. Piano jazz is one. Some of the programs of interest to minorities, they did carry the Tabitha Smiley program, but I don't think that's on anymore. But there are a couple of other NPR programs, mainly dealing with minority issues, which WJAB does carry. And here's just a little bit of what they sound like.
WJAB, your smooth jazz and cool vocal station from the campus of Alabama A&M University in Huntsville.
Good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock. I'm Erica Fox with a preview of WJAB News following NPR News. A white supremacist has been sentenced for an attack on an elderly black man. Four senior football players accused of hazing have been expelled. An ex-Mississippi prep coach will appear in federal court. Also, the Alabama Music Hall of Fame is trying to rebuild its endowment, and the Grand Ole Opry is reopening its doors. These stories and your weather forecast, but first, NPR News.
NPR News in Washington, I'm Pam Coulter.
I left that sounder on between the news headlines and NPR News so you could see how long, or a little bit ahead of the clock, Erica Fox was and how they had to leave it on to get into NPR. I think some people like to hear how stations do execute. Moving up to 91.7, the last non-commercial station, we meet the Bible Broadcasting Network. Some of you may be familiar with BBN. I believe they're based in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they have both full-power stations and translators around the South. I don't know if they have stations in other places. Here we have WYFD, officially licensed to Decatur, but a full-power station that certainly serves Huntsville. Now, the Bible Broadcasting Network is a very traditional Christian network. When I use the word traditional, I don't mean to say conservative in the political sense, like a lot of Christian broadcasters. They pretty much stay away from politics. I mean traditional in mostly the kind of music they have. If you like the old-fashioned hymns and sacred music of years back, then you might really like Bible Broadcasting Network. And even I, as a non-religious person, have to say that some of their music is really beautiful, particularly around Christmas time when it's really gorgeous. They also do have some preaching programs, not necessarily originated by BBN, but other Christian preaching programs that are around. One bad thing, in my opinion, about BBN, they don't allow their local stations any autonomy whatsoever. You'll hear no local news. You'll hear no information about your local churches. You will hear no local church services. You'll hear nothing like that on BBN. And at 2 p.m. Central Time, they have recordings of the Bible read by the wonderful reader Alexander Scorby. Those of you who've been receiving talking books for several years may remember Alexander Scorby. So we'll let you hear just a sample of that along with their ID.
For more information on getting a copy of today's broadcast, you can visit us at bbnradio.org. Go to the program schedule and then click on Building Blocks for the Family. bbnradio.org. Inspiration and information. WYFD Decatur.
Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path.
Now BBN presents daily Bible reading. We read through the whole Bible every year, and we will begin the book of Jonah.
Thanks, Tim. And that's our final Market Scope for 2010. Of course, look for us in 31 days for more of Huntsville's FMs. Remember, if you'd like to share your hometown stations with other audio service members, just send a recording to me, Phil Wayne, at 313 Spring Street, Upper Sandusky, Ohio, 43351, 1652. All who enjoy this crazy column would be most thankful. And from my microphone to your speaker, may you experience a very blessed Christmas and a prosperous, wonderful 2011. Now here is our own resident Santa Claus, Fred, with more radio stuff.
On last month's issue, we were talking about an article that's titled At Sam Zell's Tribune, Tales of a Bankrupt Culture, which was written by David Carr in the New York Times. Let's pick up on that article. A New Culture, Staff Cutbacks and Promotions. While the new owners and managers went about changing the corporate tone at Tribune, they were also under pressure to service the enormous debt. In his initial tour of the company, Sam Zell promised there would be no job cuts. But like every other media company caught in the downdraft of advertising revenue, the company was forced to cut staff and slash budgets. Everywhere, the company introduced promotions that seemed to have been drawn from the radio playbook. At four of the company's television studios, an event called Cash Grab, in which a viewer was led into the bank vault and allowed to scoop up dollar bills, was inserted into the middle of the station's newscast. At WPIX-TV in New York, the viewers were cheered on by clapping Hooters waitresses, giving the station the appearance of a televised shock radio. Mr. Abrams, who describes himself as an economic dunce, was made Tribune's chief innovation officer in March of 2008. In his new role, he peppered the staff with streams of consciousness memos, some of which went on for 5,000 typo-ridden idiosyncrasy words, some that left some amused and some bewildered.
Rock and roll musically is behind us. News and information is the new rock and roll, he wrote in one memo sent in 2008. He expressed surprise that the Los Angeles Times reporters covering the war in Iraq were still actually there. James Warren, the former managing editor and Washington bureau chief of the Chicago Tribune, said, "They wheeled around here doing everything they wished, showing a clear contempt for most everyone that was here and used power just because they had it. They used the notion of reinventing the newspapers simply as a cover for cost-cutting." As a contributor to the Chicago News Cooperative, Mr. Warren writes a column that appears in the Chicago edition of the New York Times. In Chicago, Mr. Lipinski said it had become clear that Mr. Zell was not above using the newspaper as a tool for his other business interests. In June of 2008, Mr. Zell approached her at a meeting, saying that the Chicago Tribune should be harder on Governor Rod Blagojevich. She reminded him that the newspaper had aggressively investigated the governor and that its editorial page had already called for his resignation. "Don't be a pussy," he told her. "You can always be harder on him." In a news meeting later that same day, she found out that Mr. Zell was in negotiations to sell Wrigley Field to the State Sport Authority. It was hard to avoid the conclusion that he was trying to use the newspaper to put pressure on Blagojevich. Through a spokeswoman, Terry Holt, Mr. Zell denied he used the newspaper to business ends. "From day one, Sam vowed never to interfere with the editorial content of any of the Tribune's media properties, and he's always honored that commitment," Ms. Holt said. In a criminal complaint, federal authorities accused Mr. Blagojevich of trying to trade public financing of the stadium for the dismissal of some members of the Tribune's editorial board. An aide to the governor, charged with pursuing the matter, reported back that Mr. Zell, quote, "got the message and is very sensitive to the issue," unquote, according to a criminal complaint filed by the United States Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois. In August, Mr. Blagojevich was convicted on one of 24 felony counts he faced, lying to FBI agents and about his involvement in campaign fundraising. Ms. Lipinski said that this was an episode and other conflicts with management that prompted her resignation in July of 2008, just 1 month after Scott Smith, the newspaper's longtime publisher, left. Quote, "I was plenty used to crisis and in many ways thrived on it," unquote, said Ms. Lipinski, who had joined the newspaper as an intern in 1978. "But this nonsense was a form of intentional, man-made distraction that made the work impossible. I couldn't protect my staff from what they could see plainly with their own eyes." Mr. Zell's various approaches didn't slow the company's decline. In the third quarter of 2008, the company posted a loss of $124 million, and the recession made it difficult to sell the Cubs. His purchase of Tribune became, as he even described it, the deal from hell, and the company filed for bankruptcy on December 8th of 2008. It wasn't simply the huge debt that burdened the company. The performance under the new management continued to slide. While its television division has since done well in the advertising rebound, overall, the 23 stations are on track in 2010 to pass the $1 billion mark in revenue for the first time since 2007, Tribune's newspapers have continued to underperform the rest of the industry. Advertising has been inserted into the Los Angeles Times in new and unsettling ways. In March, an ad mimicking the front page for Disney's Alice in Wonderland was wrapped around the first section, and in July, a fake version of the newspaper section for late breaking news called LATE Extra was wrapped around the real one promoting Universal Studios' King Kong attraction, with the lead story that read, "Universal Studios Partially Destroyed." In April of 2009, an advertisement posing as a news article about NBC's new show Southland appeared on the front page. In July, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, the governing board of the County of Los Angeles, sent a letter of protest saying that use of advertising disguised as news makes a mockery of the newspaper's mission. The ads do not seem to have helped. The Chicago Tribune circulation continues to slide, with weekday circulation down 9.8% for the first half of 2010. The Los Angeles Times is in the worst shape, having lost 14.7% of its weekday circulation of the period. Overall, the industry's loss of 8.7% weekly circulation in that same period. Radio, which was the core expertise of the management, has a mixed record since the takeover. After bringing in many longtime associates of Mr. Michaels, WGN Radio, the company's well-known talk radio station in Chicago, lost the market share in 2009. The station manager sent a note last month to Tribune managers asking them to call into one of the new hosts because few actual listeners were. But a company spokesman said that the ratings in the morning were up 20% from the month of August. In an effort to shake up the station, the management jettisoned a sports talk show at night and installed someone with no radio experience, Jim Lasky, an Illinois politician who had been convicted of felony. Steve Cochran, a longtime midday host, who said he was dismissed as he was walking out of the bathroom this summer, said that the changes seem aimed at destroying WGN. This was supposed to be their comfort zone, what they were good at, and they have ruined a radio station that has had an 80-year relationship with its listeners, he said. This is a collection of carnival workers who are only looking after their friends, giving jobs to their buddies. Blagojevich is on trial, and you bring in a politician who's done time in jail? The bankruptcy. Creditors lose, as do workers. More than the Tribune's creditors took a haircut. The shares that about 10,000 non-union employees received in the ESOP deal are now worthless as a result of the bankruptcy. Although at the beginning of the year, the company replaced ESOP's plan with a cash incentive contribution. But if and when the Tribune exits bankruptcy, the value of the company will be worth substantially less than when Mr. Zell bought a controlling interest. Under a proposed settlement filed recently with the court, senior leaders including the Angelo Gordon Hedge Fund and the Oak Tree Capital Management would receive $5.5 billion, while other lenders with less priority would receive far less. The case is in mediation. How can anyone say that they have done a good job, said Henry Weinstein, a former Los Angeles Times reporter who filed a lawsuit, still pending, that contends that the use of employee pensions to finance a deal was illegal. Anybody can make money when you're not servicing the debt and cutting people. Zell and the other people he brought in had no idea what they were doing. And Mr. Zell? On October 13th, his lawyers suggested that if other junior creditors were paid, he should get his money back as well. Until the bankruptcy is resolved, Mr. Zell's hand-picked team will continue to run the company. But it is frozen out of any large strategic alliances or purchases. The issue of who will run the company will remain unsettled until the bankruptcy is resolved. Mr. Zell remains the chairman of the board and is no longer involved in the day-to-day operations of the company. Despite the company's problems, the managers have been rewarded handsomely. From May of 2009 to February of 2010, a total of 57.3 million dollars in bonuses were paid to the current management, with the approval of the judge overseeing the bankruptcy. In 2009, the top 10 managers received $5.9 million at the time, when cash flow was plummeting. Mr. Woods, the board member, said, "I think they earned those bonuses. They've done a fabulous job and in very difficult circumstances." At the time, the court-appointed trustee in the bankruptcy case filed an objection, writing that, while the current owners argued for shared sacrifice, they failed to understand what the concept means when it comes to compensating their management. And then he added, "Now is not the time for yet another round of bonuses." The other proposed bonus on the table for 2010 could bring the figure for management pay enhancements to over $100 million. And those bonuses are heavily weighed to the top of the management. Earlier this week, management announced that the beginning of 2011, it would be awarding merit raises to non-union employees of about 3%. You have advertising wrapped around sections and being disguised as news and empty desks all around you. And then you read about these ridiculous bonuses and feathering their nests with severances. You just want to scream, said Steve Lopez, a longtime columnist with the Los Angeles Times. The creditors, which also include J.P. Morgan Chase and the Deutsche Bank Company, have acquiesced through the lucrative bonuses in part because they fear the antagonistic management could further hold up the company's emergence from bankruptcy, according to two lawyers representing creditors who did not want to be quoted publicly during the bankruptcy negotiations. "No one is in charge here," said an advisor to one of the senior creditors who declined to speak on the record because it was not in his business interest to be in conflict with the current board management. Mr. Michaels suggested in a public statement that his current team was very much in charge. According to the company's monthly statements, cash flow is on the rise, and the company has $1.6 billion in cash on hand, and about half of it is from the sale of the Cubs, which Mr. Zell eventually managed to sell. "We're just getting started," he said in his announcement. And management is still confident that the new thinking has the Tribune on the right track. The company's recent announcement, the creation of a new local news format in which there would be no on-air anchors and few live reports. The newscasts will rely on narration over streams of clips, a web-centric approach that has been an added benefit of requiring fewer bodies to produce. Quote, "The TV revolution is upon us, and the new Tribune Company is leading the resistance," unquote, the announcement read. And judging from the job posting for anti-establishment producers and editors, the company has some strong ideas about who those revolutionaries will be. Quote, "Don't sell us on your solid newsroom experience. We don't care. Or your exclusive breaking news coverage will pass." This article was originally published in the New York Times.
AM radio, my first real love. Jim Withers wrote this in a recent Radio World article. "I have a certain fondness in my heart for AM radio. I suspect this is true for many broadcasting veterans of my, shall we say, length of service in the human race. When I got my first ham radio license at the age of 11, it was because I really wanted to be a radio guy. New operators like me were limited to tapping out messages in Morse code. All of us longed for the day when we could flip the plate switch on a Heathkit DX40 and talk into an actual microphone. My voice blasting out of my attic ham shack at the speed of light, circling the globe. or not. Since the blast from the venerable Heath was really more of a dribble at around 40 watts or so, and then only if you would scream into the mic. I mastered the technique, though, and could reliably get a 40-watt light bulb tied to the output to throw out a respectable number of lumens when I yelled, "Testing! Testing! Testing!" My neighbors, who just knew me as the pest who interfered with their TV reception, must have wondered what exactly I was testing all the time. It was AM radio, and I loved it. Even before I could transmit, I was an avid receiver and, as they called it in those days, AM band DXer. DX is telegraph ease for distance, and I was right there with my dad's old Zenith Model 7 console radio, sweeping my way across the AM band, looking for the station no one else could hear. Dad had bought an RCA 12-inch black-and-white television set that had a cabinet the size of our bathroom. There was simply no way both it and the Zenith could coexist with his easy chair in our cramped living room. He would have been reclining on the back porch watching TV with a pair of binoculars trained on the screen like an artillery spotter. So I got the Zenith. I lugged it up to my hideout in the attic, hooked up a long-wire antenna, and started listening. I eventually knew and dutifully logged all of the Clear Channel stations east of the Rocky Mountains, including WOAI in San Antonio, the first Clear Channel station to become a Clear Channel station owned by Clear Channel Corporation. The Zenith had a wonderful magic eye tuning tube that glowed green. The stronger the signal, the greener the little shining tube glowed, and the closer together came the shadow marks. The radio itself emitted a very satisfying hum when it was working properly and filled the heaterless attic with a glow and warmth that I still remember, squirreled away up there on a cold night while the Zenith hummed and toasted along, listening to stations in cities and towns that I got to visit through AM radio. In the 1960s, I got a car and a girlfriend, and so that was the end of the Zenith. I no longer wanted to warm up to a radio, if you know what I mean. The Zenith was retired once again, and I began tuning around on the Delco AM radio in my 56 Chevy. Now, car radios of the day were not all that married to the idea of high fidelity, so the car designers stuck the speaker wherever it would fit. In the Chevy, that was in the top center of the dashboard. Since the dashboard was also the perfect milkshake and French fry table, all manner of odds and ends got spilled and dumped up there. Coins, paper clips, toothpicks, milkshake straws, the occasional petrified French fry. All of it ended up on the dashboard, where it, of course, eventually bounced down through the speaker grate onto the speaker cone itself. The sun also baked the paper cone into the rough equivalent of ancient parchment. So what with that and the vibrating French fries and coin toss, the sound was pretty awful. For a year or so, until I finally crawled up underneath the dash and replaced the speaker, I thought the primary instrument of most rock groups was the kazoo. AM radio in the 60s was really the only game in town. There were plenty of stations to choose from, both locally and, given the way AM propagates at night, across the nation. It was against my personal coolness code to cruise around in the Chevy before 9 p.m., but that meshed perfectly with the physics of AM skip. We had some great AM rock stations in St. Louis, but I preferred the bigger game that came out after dark, and so left all but one of my push buttons set to out-of-town stations. WABC was the gold standard. WLS and WCFL were favorites. No one ever said the W except me, since I aspired to be Larry Lujack and spent endless hours saying WLS in my best radio voice. KOMA in Oklahoma City was good. Bill Clinton and I were probably listening to the mighty 1090 KWAY in Little Rock at the same time, though I'll bet he did better in the back seat of his car than I did in mine. In 1965, the new car warranty expired on my parents' 1962 Ford Falcon. They decided that if we were going to take that long-anticipated family vacation, it had better be before the planned obsolescence cycle kicked in the following year and the car collapsed into a pile of steel framed by four tires. That car had a Philco AM radio, the first car radio I ever heard that did not have a vibrator in it for the power supply. Set aside the vibrator's later consumer uses, Car radios of the 40s and 50s used an altogether different device. It was a little metal can containing a vibrating contactor that turned DC battery voltage into AC, which could then be stepped up to higher voltage, turned back into DC, and finally used to power the tubes. Complicated, yes, but absolutely vital when you really, really needed an Otis Redding moment after sharing that chocolate milkshake on a Friday night date. In any event, back in the Falcon, we chugged across the Continental Divide, vibratorless, while I listened to KCMO in Kansas City, KOB, KSL in Salt Lake, and finally, the mecca of AM radio, outside of New York City at least, Los Angeles.
The Sunset Strip, the Hollywood Hills, from the harbor to the valley. This is Los Angeles, the giant of the West.
Oh, man. Robert W. Morgan. Good Morgan, Los Angeles. It's Robert W. He, of course, pronounced it double U in the Morgan. The real Don Steele. Was there an imposter, a fake Don Steele? KRLA, KHJ, KFI. More 50,000-watt screamers than even I could keep track of. Well, along about this time back in St. Louis, the local NBC television and radio affiliate put on a stereo broadcast demonstration. FM was, of course, on the air by then, playing oh-so-soft mortuary music, which was an order of magnitude less descript and more somber than elevator music, but it was largely broadcast in mono. So, to introduce the unwashed masses, that'd be those of us who had never been to a mortuary and only rarely traveled in elevators, to stereo music, they broadcast one channel on the TV station and one on KSD AM radio. That demonstration with audio carefully chosen to maximize the stereo effect. And now, ladies and gentlemen, a jet airliner will seem to fly right through your living room. It was a bit goofy, but still, for me, it marked the real day the music died on AM radio. FM stereo came soon after and killed the top 40 AM station. Slowly, I, along with most of the rest of the audience, left AM behind for the full fidelity fields of FM. During the 70s and 80s, I never even bothered to program the AM buttons on my car radios. It was all music all the time, and I began to think of AM radio in Newton Minow's terms, a vast wasteland. Then, in 1989, I had the opportunity to drive across country in a company vehicle. Like a lot of fleet cars in those days, this one was stripped of anything non-essential, and so had only an AM radio. Well, yikes! 2 days on the road with nothing to listen to? Except that it was on that trip that I rediscovered AM radio to my complete delight. Every town, large, small, and in between, has an AM radio station. Unlike a lot of small-market FM stations that are plugged into satellite dishes for 22 out of 24 hours, many of these AMers are run by actual humans. The result for me was a running town-by-town local and regional commentary as I drove across America. Driving in the Deep South, it was hard to find a town that didn't have a Southern gospel station preaching an Elmer Gantry sermon. In the Midwest, I learned an awful lot about pork bellies and wheat futures. Into Oklahoma and Texas, it was country, and I mean Patsy Cline picking and strumming country, giving way to Tex-Mex and Tejano about 100 miles south of Dallas. I heard more accordion music in Texas than Lawrence Welk ever thought of playing. And, of course, every couple of 100 miles, a blowtorch. KMOX, WWL, KRLD, WBAP, WOAI. Major market coverage and events, but in between, the big guys, town doings, high school sports, little tidbits of folks' lives. And all of it comes through the local AM station. It was like driving back in time, and I loved every minute of it. I ended up owning an AM radio station in Texas. I divided the net profit by the number of hours I work at this endeavor each month, and if I was schizophrenic, I would sue myself for underpayment of the federal minimum wage. It's not the easiest game in town by a long shot, but for all of that, it is a lot of fun. And I do sometimes wonder, in the middle of a long night at the transmitter site, trying to squeeze that last watt up into the antenna, if there's a kid out there somewhere, not yet jaded by the internet and iPods, cell phones, and texting, who, with the help of an old AM radio, has just stopped by for a visit. And that story in a recent Radio World News magazine issue was written by Jim Withers. He's the owner of KSIX AM in Corpus Christi, Texas, and a partner in KRBKDT, Springfield, Missouri. You can reach him at jgwithers@earthlink.net. This is Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
And that ties the bow on this edition of the DX Audio Service, the holiday edition of the DX Audio Service. We'll see you in 2011 for yet another year of the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service. Until next time, 73 good DX, and get out and support radio.